This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Dr. Drew Lanham, who is alumni distinguished professor at Clemson University, and a few years back he was named alumni master teacher. Drew is the author of a number of books. He's by profession a zoologist and a forest resources person. He was an engineer before he saw the light for biology. But he has written a wonderful memoir, The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. And it is a love affair. Drew, welcome to the journal.
Thank you for having me, Walter. It's good to be here.
It's really my pleasure. The Home Place. Let's just first of all identify that for everybody.
Well, the home place is Edgefield, South Carolina. For the listeners who don't know where that is, it sits right across the river from Augusta, Georgia. But Edgefield, South Carolina, in a little corner of the county, southwestern corner called Colliers, is the name of the community. But that home place included my grandmother's house, which was built sometime, I don't know, in the 20s or maybe 30s. And then my parents' house, which sat just across the pasture within hollering distance, which was actually a home that my grandfather used to rent out. But then my father moved into that house, and my parents eventually added an old army barracks to that original house. And so that home place included sort of the forests and the fields that encompassed my grandmother's house, the ramshackle, as I call it in the book, and my parents' house, the ranch.
How was the soil there?
The soil, clay.
Yes.
A lot of clay, you know. So it made for good dirt clods and throwing at your brother and your sister and them throwing them back at me. But there was also this very rich loamy soil in the bottoms. And you know, up on the hills, on some of those terraces, you know, you had rich soil that my father grew butter beans in, and purple hull peas and corn and all sorts of things. We had a family vegetable garden, which was pretty large, that the clay soil was augmented by manure.
And you had ample supply. You kept, what, about 30, 40 head of cattle?
Yeah. At most, 40 head of cattle and a few hogs for meat and sometimes chickens. So that place, you know, you ask about the soil, was such a diverse place, you know, because Daddy also, he was a school teacher as my mother was, and during the summertime they had to have income, and so my father would truck farm, and he grew watermelons. And the watermelons grew best up on this, in this field that was up the road a little bit, that was very sandy. And so here's this little sandy portion of land where Daddy knew that the watermelons would grow best and taste sweetest from that place.
Well, just like in Hampton County.
Of course. Of course. You know, I mean, it's and that's the thing about Edgefield and that ridge. You go over into the eastern portions of the county, and I like to tell my friends from Gaffney and the other places where they think they grow peaches well. that the ridge in Johnston in eastern Edgefield County is where you find the absolute sweetest peaches.
And that's where the peach industry in South Carolina started back before 1860.
Sure.
People don't actually realize that they were shipping boxcars of peaches north to the New York market before the Civil War.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when you talk about, well, for us, the summertime, you know, we had our own little peach grove, and my parents actually would go to a cannery. There was an old cannery on Macedonia Street in Edgefield, and they would, all the peaches that they could can in about a 2 or 3 week period of time, and when I say canned, I mean steel cans. And so the processor was there, the peaches would be cooked, canned, cooked, and we had peaches forever. So I can't say I ever got tired of peach cobbler, but it was nonstop. And so the bounty of Edgefield, sort of born of the soil in many ways, is part of what makes it an extraordinary place.
Okay. Was that cannery in a school by any chance?
You know, it was connected to a school.
Okay.
It was.
Okay, because during the Depression, and it was the Clemson Extension Service, they put canneries attached to schools mm-hmm. really to encourage people to quit growing cotton and grow food to feed themselves because people were starving in South Carolina in the 30s. So I was just curious because that reminded me of those projects that were part of the New Deal.
Well, Walter, that's incredible that you mentioned that because part of what I can remember from this cannery is outside of it and sort of cast aside were all these old desks. And so some of those desks were incorporated into other people's houses, and I can remember having a couple of them around my parents' house. And so, you know, not very many people want to be associated with desks beyond school, but there they were. And so it was always sort of curious to me, sort of this canning operation that would open up just for us to can peaches. Sometimes we get to can tomatoes and corn and things like that. But peaches were the main thing.
Your parents were both school teachers.
Uh-huh.
Your mother had a very interesting education where she went to college.
Right. Mama decided that she was born in 96. South Carolina, and as a neighbor had Benjamin E. Mays right around the corner. And her sister, my Aunt Moselle, went to South Carolina State. And Mama, being a little sister, decided that she didn't want to emulate her. Mm-hmm. And so she chose to go out of state to Talladega College, which is in the Appalachian Mountains of Alabama, a small teacher's college. And Mama went to Talladega. That was a school that was training teachers and other professionals. But she always said she wanted to be different. Mm-hmm. And Talladega gave her that opportunity to be different. And from Talladega, she went to Fisk mm-hmm. University. So I like to say that Mama sort of had, at least for that time, kind of a Southern Black College Ivy League education.
Absolutely. Talladega was a good school, but Fisk was top tier.
Yeah, and the Fisk Jubilee Singers
yes.
That the school is known famously for, but Fisk has been responsible for producing so many of the elite in the Black community yeah. That, you know, I look at my mother as no less heroic and elite in what she did mm-hmm. as a school teacher.
And your dad was a school teacher, too.
Yeah, Daddy was a school teacher, and Daddy was educated at, a couple of places. One of the interesting places in Edgefield County was Bettis Academy.
Now let's talk a minute about Bettis, because it is an important, not just an African-American story, but a mm-hmm. South Carolina story.
Yeah, Walter, it was sort of in the fashion of, I think they're called the Rosenwald Schools.
Okay.
But not formally one of those schools.
Okay. All right, Rosenwald Schools, for listeners who don't know, Julius Rosenwald, a very wealthy northerner, would give money to southern schools, primarily African, rural schools, but primarily African American. Mm-hmm. It was not a complete donation, but he would match the funds that they would raise from themselves to build schools, because in the early 20th century, not much money was going into Black schools in the American South, certainly one going into Black schools in South Carolina.
Right, right. So Bettis Academy was sort of in that fashion, founded by a former slave, Alexander Bettis, Reverend Alexander Bettis, who apparently could read but could not write. And so as that school was established, my grandfather, Joseph Samuel Lanham, taught there. And then my father attended junior college there in part, I believe. But Daddy, you can look at some of the old rolls of the people who attended that school in Edgefield, from Edgefield County, from Trenton in particular. But a particular interest to me, and my mother's done a lot of the historic restoration on that campus now, and you could barter your tuition. Mm-hmm. And so students were bringing in sacks of grain or flour or jars of molasses, and they were working. So sort of in the model of a school that some people are familiar with, a place like Warren Wilson up in North Carolina, mm-hmm. where you sort of work your way towards an education. But Bettis Academy was responsible for a large part of what that community became, including my father. And Daddy left there. He left Bettis Academy and went to Claflin College in Orangeburg and finished his education, his undergraduate education there, and then went to Virginia State. And he and my mother actually went west to Oregon, to the University of Oregon in the late 50s, in part because there were opportunities offered there for graduate education that weren't being offered in South Carolina, in the South, because of segregation.
And, of course, ironically, you know who paid for their education, don't you? The state of South Carolina.
Yes.
Because they couldn't get a graduate degree here. The state of South Carolina would pay for African Americans to get graduate degrees somewhere else.
To go elsewhere. And it's funny that, you know, the irony of the story of having to leave home to come back and appreciate it more at home in ways. They were both teaching at Parker Colored School in Edgefield. And as my parents went west, Mama would tell the story of not feeling comfortable in that car trip west until they got somewhere in Missouri. They would get on the other side of Missouri, and she said Missouri was odd. She said you could stop at one place and it was highly segregated and dangerous to be there, and you'd get to another place and it was okay. But she said for sure once they got into western Missouri, into Nebraska, they were okay. And sort of this relative freedom that they felt in Oregon and being able to be in this place where they could learn without the same sort of stigma that they would have faced here.
So you're really talking about the late 1950s.
Late 1950s, early 60s.
Okay, the civil rights movement was just getting started,
mm-hmm.
and African Americans were not welcome even to stop at filling stations.
Yeah, it's, you know, as a wildlife ecologist, I spent a lot of time studying range maps of species of animals, sort of the things that constrain them or allow them to expand beyond where they would begin. And for black folks in the late 50s, early 60s, and of course preceding that, and maybe even now, you had to watch where you went and how you traveled. And so, of course, it was a segregated society, and so you had to know where you'd be able to stop to buy gas, where you'd be able to stop to eat, and for the most part, you were going to have to go in some side or back door to eat. You were going to have carry out. You weren't going to be able to sit in a restaurant. And so my parents apparently mapped this out, and it was formally mapped out in a green book, mm-hmm. in a guidebook.
Yes.
That told black folks where they could go, where they could stop, the safe places to sort of rest. So, you know, my parents' range map as an ornithologist, as a person who studies birds and how they migrate, it intrigues me. I think my father in some ways was opened up to some different sorts of possibilities from a man, from a father who, you know, we mentioned the early 20s and sort of the Depression era. South and especially South Carolina. And part of the mystery and sort of the wonderful mystery that this book has opened up was how my grandfather made it in Edgefield County at that time.
That was my next question. Your father was a World War I veteran.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather, rather, mm-hmm. who actually served in a black unit that was a military unit, not
yes.
engineers or truck drivers or what have you.
Right, right.
So he was a combat veteran of World War I.
Yeah, he was a combat veteran. I bought the book that was written about some of these units. And of course the Harlem Hellfighters are the most famous unit, black unit that fought. But once those soldiers got overseas, they were mostly stripped of their US uniforms and I believe even their US arms, and they were given over to the French. And so my grandfather was in several of the famous battles in World War I, was injured there. My grandmother used to read me some of the letters that he wrote about being in the horrors of trench warfare. And so he came back to the United States and, according to my grandmother, lobbied for them to go back to France in part. because he had seen sort of a freedom there that that wasn't being expressed here in the United States. Then, after she apparently convinced him to stay in Edgefield, he somehow in the 1920s, when apparently things weren't going very well for South Carolina, I think the boll weevil had a little bit to do with
the
that.
Well, right at the end of World War I, cotton prices collapsed. Mm-hmm. We went into about a 3 or 4 year drought. The boll weevil came in, and you know, this was when you had the great mass exodus, primarily of African Americans to the north, and whites west.
Yeah,
people just shut the farm doors and left.
Well, that's an extraordinary thing to me because, again, I look at that land, and we started this conversation with soil and with so much clay being there, and assuming that a lot of what used to be topsoil ended up somewhere way down the Savannah River. This man coming back to Edgefield when there didn't seem to be much there, and somehow on the precipice of even worse times in the Depression, was able to have a successful farm. And some of the documents that I found in the ruins of my grandmother's house, old Farm Service Agency documents that indicated that he was mapping the land, that he was rotating crops, but that he had also developed this successful milk and egg business in the midst of the worst of times, really sort of informs our story, I'd like to say. And for me, and thinking about my parents later going west and going to all these places getting an education, I'd like to think that some of that time that Joseph Samuel Lanham spent on that land, farming it after being gassed and injured in World War I, and being productive somehow on lands that other people weren't productive on, couldn't be productive on for various reasons, makes it a heroic story to me.
Well, it absolutely does. Now, did you actually know your grandfather? Had he died before you were born?
He did. He died before I was born in 1961, I believe. And part of that was from complications of those wounds that he never really recovered from. I can remember on my grandmother's on her screen porch, there was this leg brace there that had a shoe attached. He hadn't lost a leg, but apparently he had been maimed in one leg, and apparently had some respiratory problems from being gassed during the war. And that helmet, that doughboy helmet that he was issued when he was, I believe, at Camp Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
At Camp Jackson here in Columbia, that hung on the porch for a very long time. So I never knew him. I knew him from letters. I knew him from photographs, and I knew him from stories, and in part knew him from my grandmother talking to his disembodied spirit most nights.
Your grandmother, what a wonderful character. And I use that term because she was a character.
Yes, she was.
So, and you called her name?
Mamatha.
Mamatha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And extremely religious.
Yeah.
Very fundamentalist Baptist, as near as I can.
Oh, yeah. Very, very much so, Walter. She prayed every day, several times a day. She was always calling on the Lord for something, and at night it was, we would end most nights. Of course, I stayed with her from before I was 1 year old until I was 16, father had died.
Now, why was that?
From the stories I've been told, my grandmother, my grandfather had died. Joseph had died a few years before I came along, and my grandmother was lonely. You know, she was in this house mostly by herself, and asked for me, and so I was sort of loaned to her long term. There wasn't any return date on me like a library book, and so I was at her house for half of my life up until I was a teenager, until I was 16 years old. When I wasn't old enough to walk, someone would come pick me up and I'd go to school. And then at night, I'd go back to my grandmother's place. As I got older, I started walking from her house to my parents' house, which was a distance a little less than a quarter of a mile. But as a kid, it just seemed like forever. And especially if you had to do it at night.
Yeah.
It seemed much, much longer.
But, and it was uphill to her house, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, her house sort of sat... there was a spring down the hill from her house. I left her house. I had to walk up a little hill, crest the hill, and then go downhill to my parents' house. And the pasture in between was, for lack of a better word, was really sort of like a holler, you know, just sort of this this valley almost. And now it's all grown up with loblolly pine and sweet gum, and the deer love it. But back then it was just wide open. And you could see her house from my parents' house, and just sort of this idyllic setting. Of course, her house was, you know, very much older and a tin roof that seemed more rusty than intact, and very little insulation in the house. She had indoor plumbing, one bathroom, and no air conditioning, of course, except for open windows at night, and an old Ashley heater that she that was in the bedroom that heated the house. There was a fireplace that I never saw her light a fire in.
Okay. That was really like an old potbelly stove, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, it was. She had a potbellied stove that she would occasionally light when she was quilting, and she would quilt in this room where the ice box was. I mostly call refrigerators ice boxes because that's what she called her refrigerator. But she had this other stove that was this really heavy cast iron beast that she cooked the most amazing meals in. And so there was this constant industry that we had, my daddy and my brother and I, of cutting wood. To make sure that she stayed warm and that she could cook. Mm-hmm. And so she never modernized. She never modernized. And so calling on God all the time and praying all through the day, and at night she would have me read the Bible.
But at the same time, she did believe in the spirit world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was seamless almost. That after I'd read out of the Bible, usually something out of Proverbs, if I was lucky, or if I was unlucky, Revelations, and I'd read that. And then sometime over in the night, over in the early morning, sort of in these quiet hours, she would begin to just talk out very lucidly and often call my grandfather's name and ask him questions. But then the next morning, she would tell me about these conversations, and she would tell me about these visits. And so I slept for a good portion of my childhood with the quilts over my head because I really didn't want to see who or what it was that she was having these conversations with. But so my grandmother, there seemed to never be any conflict between sort of this very religious Baptist, this fundamentalist sort of alignment that she had, and the spirit world. I mean, she pulled pain out of my stomach with incantations and all sorts of things. So it was a different kind of upbringing for a kid of the 70s.
Okay, you were born in 61?
I was born in 65. So 65. I was at the tail end of the baby boom. Oh, okay. I was the last class of colored babies out of the University Hospital in Augusta. My birth certificate says I was colored, and says I was born in that segregated unit.
In 1965. That's the University of Georgia Medical School Hospital.
Yes.
In Augusta. Mm-hmm. Okay. Drew, we have to pause a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. Drew Lanham of Clemson University about his memoir, The Home Place. The title, is that what they called your father's farm, literally the home place, right?
Yeah. It was the home place, and you know, I know it's sort of a common name, but you know, I heard that more after I left it. you know, that it was the home place, and that sort of that title sort of stuck with me. And I, you know, if I may, I mentioned my parents leaving home to sort of gain an education to come back so they could in some ways be more appreciated here. This story, at least as far as the writing of it, really sort of took me leaving home to sort of recognize it. And so one night in a little draconian dorm room at a tiny college in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont called Sterling College.
I know the Northeast Kingdom.
You know the Northeast Kingdom.
And I can say that because I spent a time as visiting professor at Middlebury College, which is not in the Northeast Kingdom.
Right, right.
But the Northeast Kingdom is sort of a pejorative, like the dark corner here in South Carolina.
Wow. Yeah. I never thought of it like that, but you're exactly right. And for me, it had this sort of familiar feel of just a rural base, not having to lock your doors, of bird song being more prevalent than any other sound. And so to go to that place, to Sterling College, which at the time I think had an enrollment of 123, 124 students.
Well, why'd you go there?
Walter, I went there in part to try to meet a Southern writer, a Southern nature writer named Janice Ray, who wrote a book called Ecology of a Cracker Childhood. And I read that book after having read, of course, the Sand County Almanac and Thoreau's Walden and so much other nature writing. But Janice's book was about the South. And it was written lyrically, and it was written evocatively, and I could almost hear her voice. And I wanted to meet the person who had written about, you know, my homeland in such in such a moving way. And so she was at the time sort of a Georgia expat. She was living up there in Brattleboro.
Okay.
And there was a writing workshop up there called the Wild Branch Nature Writing Workshop. And my department chair at the time sensed, I think, that I was ready to kind of make a move academically, at least in terms of how I was communicating conservation. And she gave me the go-ahead and some support to actually go to Vermont for a week to this writing workshop. And I was given an assignment by my workshop facilitator, Diana Capel Smith. I'll never forget it. I was the only man in this writing circle, and she gave us this assignment, and she said, "I want you to write 500 words tonight about a place that moves you in some way." And of course, I've been an academician, and I was sort of feeling like a fish out of water being in this place. I was the only black man there. I was one of the few men there. And then being in this circle asked to write about place, I wasn't given any sort of data. I didn't have any statistics to write about. And I sat in that little room that night trying to think about a place. And then it fell on me. It was home, Edgefield, South Carolina. And I wrote from maybe 10 to 2 a.m. that morning. And instead of 500 words, I produced somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 words.
Wow.
And it just poured mm-hmm. from me.
And that was the beginning of this book.
That was the beginning of this book. The next day, we were asked to share. I was, I don't know, third or fourth in the reading circle. And these women were reading these incredibly moving pieces that were highly personal and sort of unlike anything that I had ever heard before. Certainly within the realm of me being a college professor, I mean, you know, people deliver papers and folks sometimes have a hard time staying awake through it. There wasn't a dry eye in the house, and it came to me, but I'm thinking, okay, I've written this thing and I'll read it and we'll go on. And I couldn't make it through the first paragraph. It was a catharsis for me. It was really the first time that I had mourned my father's death as a 15-year-old, and really the first time that I had sort of also mourned the loss of of that land, of growing up in that place.
Well, let's touch on those for a minute. Your father died as a very young man. He's about 49, I think.
He's 52.
52.
52, same age as I am now.
And then you're not happy with what happened, how your kinfolk, what your kinfolk did, to, not your grandmother, but what your kinfolk did to the home place.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was sort of this whirlwind. My father died of a heart attack, drove himself halfway. My parents were working in Aiken, were teaching in Aiken, drove himself with my mother sitting in the passenger seat halfway to the university hospital. And I never saw him alive again. I was at track practice. My sister Julia picked me up, and my father had died by the time I got to the hospital. So after we buried my father and started tending to this land and cattle and all of this life that we'd had, things sort of fell apart. And my father died without a will. My grandfather apparently had never had a will. And so the phenomenon of heirs' property, which I know you're familiar with.
Yes. And having worked with several estates, the fact that your father died without an estate mm-hmm. meant that his siblings got to share in the estate with his wife and children.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they, you know, the 200, roughly 200 acres, that much of which was covered in mature forests, mature hardwood forests with trees I can remember it taking two or three people to sort of put their arms around. Once my father died, it didn't take long for the timber buyers to sort of move in. And I remember by the time some of the sale finally went through, we had divested ourselves of the cattle. The spring was just too tough to handle, and so Mama had punched a well. And I was in my freshman year at Clemson, and I would get these visits. I would get calls and then visits from attorneys, and they would try to get me to sign these papers. And they'd say, well, I got a check for you if you'll just sign these papers. And fortunately, my mother had called me, and she had warned me. She said, don't sign anything that anybody brings to you. And after a lot of battling and fighting and wrangling, my mother was able to retain about 7 acres for each of us, including the land on which the house sat. The rest of it went under the saw. And I remember visiting the land after my freshman year, going home for spring break and driving down to the house because I needed to get some stuff out of my room to take back to Clemson. And it was devastated. I hardly recognized it because all the trees were gone.
It had been clear cut?
It had been clear cut. I remember going down to the creek, Chevis Creek, where Daddy taught us to fish, and much of what could not be hauled away on a log truck had been pushed into the creek, which violates all sorts of best management practices for forestry. But I think in sort of this rush when my dad's siblings were approached with this idea of getting more money for trees than they had ever envisioned, that it was a windfall. And I think they probably took the first offer. Mm-hmm. And there was no replanting done. The land has come back in many ways voluntarily, but of course it's not been managed. You know, we have, each of us, each of my siblings, we have 7 acres. My mother has 7 acres. So we have 35 acres of it. Much of that the beavers have retaken, and so the beavers and wood duck and I'm sure some pretty decent whitetail bucks are down there. The turkeys are there. My brother lives on the land and sort of holds on to part of the legacy in that way. Otherwise, it's in the hands of my cousins mostly. Okay. All of my aunts are dead now.
And your grandmother's house?
My grandmother's house is owned by one of her daughters. Well, now one of her granddaughters, and their children. And incredibly, it still stands. It's been ransacked. I think the pickers found it pretty quickly. But to go down there and to see my grandmother's home place, to see her ramshackle house, it still stands. That smokehouse still stands. And out of that clay soil that daffodils and snowdrops are still coming up every spring is something else. And so it, you know, that sort of mystical part of of who she taught me to be sort of survives. Our my parents' house, I was down there during the Christmas holidays this past year, and decided I deer hunted my grandmother's yard literally a few years back, just to sort of be there, mm-hmm. to sort of try to recapture some of what was somehow, and had a very sort of surreal experience there. And then this past Christmas, sat on the porch of my parents' house, of that ranch. And in sitting there for probably 3 or 4 hours, but in the quiet of this very dark pre-dawn up until almost noon, it was the longest period of time that I had spent at that house since I'd left it back in 1983. So the land has the most value for white-tailed deer and wild turkeys and hopefully bobwhite quail and warblers at this point. But I still feel in many ways like I own, that we own all of that. But the deed and title says that I've got 7 acres. That's what I've got.
Okay. But we discussed part of your title, the home place.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very touching memoir. But then the subtitle is Memoir of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. Let's talk about it. You're an ornithologist as well. You're a bird watcher.
Yeah.
And although your birth certificate said you were a colored man, do you want to you amplify in your introduction as to why you deliberately chose that term?
Mm-hmm.
It's something that a person of color might not want to use in the 21st century.
Yeah, I'm a little bit stubborn in some things. It's that's sort of how I started out, you know, from that university hospital and being colored. But as James Brown, you know, used to say, I'm black and I'm proud. That's part of who I am. But then being the scientist and being someone who's always sort of in search of kind of the next truth or at least piece of data that helps define the truth, you know, you claim all of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an important thing. I mean, society obviously defines us by some line or title. And so, you know, most recently we've all sort of become hyphenated in some sort of way. And I decided pretty early on that I wanted to be inclusive in writing. And as much as you can be inclusive in a memoir and trying to remember most accurately all of the people, or people at least who've contributed to your life in ways that you know of, that it then bears that there are all sorts of people that have contributed to who it is that I am as a living being. And so most recently I decided that I wanted to sort of follow up on that and to find out who it is that I am genetically.
Okay.
And so taking several of these genetic tests where you take a swab of your cheek and you send it in, and like magic, several weeks later they send you a packet of information that spills out in charts and graphs and colorful pictures who it is that you are. And when I got back one of those tests, it says, well, guess what? You are 75% to 80% Central and West African, and your mother's people are most likely from the area of Sierra Leone and those associated areas, and most closely resemble genetically the Mende people. Which is interesting because Mama and her Talladega classmates used to walk by on a daily basis sort of that picture of the Amistad and the Mende warrior Senke.
Mm-hmm.
And so that defines me in one way. My father's people from Cameroon, from Central Africa and Bamileke, and probably being the people they're most closely associated with. But that only defines a part of me. you know, I do another test and it says, well, the rest of you is Western European and Scandinavian and Iberian and Native American and Southeast Asian and even a tinge of Neanderthal. So with all of that thrown into the mix, you know, I'm defined as a black man, as a black American, and proudly claim and hold on to that. But then there's so much more, I think, underneath all of us that defines who we are. So I think in being colored, I don't see any shame in being colored as a human being, because genetically we're all so tightly linked in ways that I think needs to be acknowledged. But then sort of historically and who we were as colored folk and the strides that black Americans had to make in spite of, whether it was going west to Oregon or being in a place like Edgefield and finding a way to be successful and to have a family and land and a farm to produce folks who were successful themselves, I think that then colored becomes, to me, sort of a badge of honor.
And your love affair with nature.
Yeah. You know, it's I tell people that I grew up with really 2.5 television channels. And those 2.5 television channels certainly offered enough in terms of cartoons and some educational programming that helped me be sort of a regular kid. But we all spent a lot of time outdoors. I was given sort of free rein to roam. Sometimes it would take me hours to get home from my grandmother's place to my parents' house, especially on a Saturday morning when there wasn't the obligation of school and I'd got my chores done. Then you could wander. You could just wander. And so in all that wandering, you notice some of everything. Colors, you notice scents. You're just sort of assaulted by just sort of this sensual kind of buffet. And I can remember that. And the sense of smell is one of our strongest sort of links to memory. Being able to go into a house and to recognize scents from that take you decades back. And so when I'm walking through the woods, one of the things that I always do if I see a lightwood stump, I'm going to look for a shred of that lightwood stump or knock a little piece away so that the people who are walking with me, when I peel away that piece of heart pine, and a lot of times it's glowing yellow, and people are able to smell it, and they can smell that strong, it almost smells like fire. And, you know, those are the sorts of things that, to me, color my life, and I can close my eyes, and I can smell, and I can see better sometimes, sort of in that darkness.
You got all your degrees at Clemson.
Mm-hmm.
You went on the faculty there.
Yeah, it was, you know, really my first intention was not to go to Clemson. It was my first intention was to go somewhere that I could major in a biological science and to be closer to the field that I wanted to be in, which not too many people were encouraged about. They said, well, you know, you're a smart black kid who's good at math and science. You got to be an engineer. You got to be an engineer. And then in the end of it, after you become an engineer and you've got this great job, you can do birds on the side. And
you had a full ride. You had a DuPont scholarship.
Yeah, yeah. I'd worked at the bum plant I'd worked the Savannah River plant, now the Savannah River site. I worked there as a high school senior, and then I worked there for 3 summers as a college intern and was making great money for a college kid. But, Walter, I was always looking for ways to sneak over to the Savannah River Ecology Lab. And
when did you have your epiphany or your temptum, like, I can't take this engineering anymore?
Oh, man. You know, it was, this was in 1985, and spring day, as a matter of fact, and I was on the way to to one of the many classes that I was doing pretty well in, but that I just disliked. It was just every day going to class was more than the task that most students hate. I deplored it. And I'd had this experience in the summer seeing what engineers did. And engineers are wonderful people. They're the ones, the people who are passionate about it are the ones who need to build our bridges, not me. And I was on the way to this class, and I stopped about halfway there. I'd been begging my scholarship sponsors almost since I'd been in school to let me change my major to something that I thought was more appropriate and that I was passionate about, and they kept refusing. And so that day, that spring day in 1985, when I just stopped in my tracks, I turned around, I went back to my room, and I said, I can't do it anymore. And I never attended another engineering class after that, and found amazingly relatively little support. I talked to my engineering sponsor. They said, well, your scholarship is gone. You've violated the conditions. People were asking, they said, well, you want to major in zoology. What are you going to do with that? Are you going to work in a zoo? How are you going to support yourself? You've given up this one of four national scholarships, and took out a student loan for a semester and came back to my, got a letter out of my mailbox one day from this place called, from Amick Farms. I had no idea where this place was. And, but I opened up this letter, and it was a $5,000 scholarship. $5,000 back in 1985 went a long way towards tuition.
Chick Amick was on the board at Clemson University.
And it was, Walter, it was a scholarship that had fallen. As many of these scholarships are first designated, this one was initially designated for someone majoring in poultry science from Lexington, Newberry, or I believe Saluda. And apparently there weren't any people there majoring, and it kept falling. And finally, I was somewhere on the list that this scholarship fell to me. And so here, in many ways, even though I had been bird watching all my life, here I was saved by a chicken or chickens. So that day in 1985, when I stopped on the sidewalk, turned around, went back to my apartment and said, I have to do what my heart tells me, is sort of, it's why I'm even here right now.
Well, before we wrap it up, I want you to read a favorite passage from your book.
Sure. I'll read a passage from a chapter called Thinking.
All right.
And the epigraph is from George Washington Carver. Nothing is more beautiful than the loveliness of the woods before sunrise. I think about land a lot. In fact, I am possessed by it. I think about the lay of the land, how it came to be, what natural forces have changed it, what human forces have mangled it, how concrete and asphalt doom it. I think about the promise it holds for the future and what history it preserves from the past. I think about how it rises and runs, lifts and falls. I think about hills and hollers. I think about great rifts and grand canyons. I think about mountains and monadnocks. I think about swamps and sandhills. I think about draws and drains. I think about the rivers running through land, the animals burrowing under it, and the birds flying over it. I think about the sounds that come from the land, the whining of katydids and crickets on steamy summer nights, the incessant serenading of red-eyed vireos on newborn spring days, and the chattering of squirrels hiding acorns on chill, crisp autumn mornings. I think about clapper rails applauding at the edge of a salt marsh stage and the teletyping dictations of pine woods tree frogs in a rain-soaked longleaf savanna. I think about the solace of winter whispered on a northwest wind and the mournful groaning of the bare-boned trees. I think about the soil underneath it all, its shifting sandiness, rough rockiness, rich loaminess, and sticky clayiness. I think about the perfume of place, the pleasant mustiness of decaying leaves on a Blue Ridge forest floor, the sulfur stink of a Beaufort mud flat at low tide, the drunken sweetness of an orchard in October.
Thank you. You're not an engineer, sir. With all due respect, that passage is so lyrical. as are others. You do have a love affair, not just with nature, but clearly with South Carolina. Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign, Drew. So any last words for our listeners?
Well, I hope that everyone sees themselves as colored somehow. I think it's a unifying, the land and what we do in South Carolina for nature, I think, is in some ways superlative. And I think we hang on to those things. And by seeing ourselves in nature somehow through the colors of nature, I think that we can come together, hopefully, for not just a better South Carolina, but better in many ways going forward.
Dr. Drew Lanham, alumni distinguished professor at Clemson, thank you so very much for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did on so many levels. As you know, I care about the environment. Drew Lanham is a scientist. I had no idea to what to expect from a zoologist until I read his book. This man truly has a love affair with the world in which he grew up, which was rural Edgefield County, but now with the entire state of South Carolina. His book, The Home Place, is well worth reading. The lyrical way in which he writes, it makes it a joy. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.